From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we comparison shop the new 1988 cars with Jack Gillis, author of The Car Book, A Guide for Consumers. Also today, I talk with jazz critic Martin Williams. He compiled the Smithsonian's new six-record set, Singers and Soloists of the Swing Bands, a nostalgia-free look back at the big bands. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward examines the making of the now-classic Phil Spector Christmas album, and book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel by William Burroughs. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Driving a new car is very exciting, but shopping for it can be among the more intimidating, nerve-wracking experiences a consumer faces. Earlier today, the Center for Auto Safety released lists of the best and worst 1988 cars, as rated by my guest, Jack Gillis. Gillis compiles this analysis for his annual publication, The Car Book, which is a guide for people in the market for a new car. He's also updated his companion volume, The Used Car Book. Both include everything from crash and repair ratings to price comparisons and showroom shopping strategies. Gillis first developed the car book in 1980 for the Department of Transportation. He's now Director of Public Affairs for the Consumer Federation of America. I spoke to him from the NPR Bureau in New York, and he told me his picks for the best 1988 cars, but first he outlined the standards he used to rate them.
Well, we look at five categories. We look at crash test performance, fuel economy, repair costs, insurance costs, that's something you often forget about while you're in the showroom. And then this year, for the first time, we're including in our ratings program warranty ratings. That's whether or not the automobile manufacturers have given that particular car an average or a good or a poor warranty.
Okay, let's look at the cars that you chose as some of the best cars for 1988. Why don't we start with subcompact, you could run through the list.
Well, that's important because we do categorize the cars by weight because weight is still an important consideration in terms of safety. In the subcompact category, the Chevrolet Nova, which is a joint venture product between GM and Toyota, Dodge Colt, Ford Escort, Mazda 323, and the Volkswagen Golf are all great choices for subcompacts.
Now, I notice what's absent in that subcompact list is either Toyotas or Hondas. You do have the Toyota MR2, but there's not many foreign cars in general.
Well, one of the reasons for that is because we can only rate cars for which we have information in all five categories. And unfortunately, the government has seriously delayed its crash test program. So, as you noted, there are some Hondas that are missing from this category. I expect that when they are finally crash tested, such cars as the Honda Civic and the Honda Prelude will do very well, and then they will then become good choices. But right now, we really don't know how they perform in crash tests.
Okay, let's look at compact.
Dodge Aries, Plymouth Reliant, Lee Iacocca's K cars are at the top of our list. And then some GM products, the Chevrolet Cavalier, the Olds Frienza, and the Pontiac Sunbird. Again, all cars that do well in such things as crash tests, fuel economy, repair cost, and have good warranties.
Now, again, all those cars are American cars. Is this part of a Buy American philosophy, or is it an absence of information about foreign cars, or are the foreign cars not performing well?
Well, when we look at the cars every year, we notice, and we have noticed over the past 3 years, a dramatic improvement in the quality and manufacture of U.S.-built cars. We still haven't closed the gap yet with our Japanese counterparts yet, but we are getting there. Again, one of the things that we look at is overall costs of maintaining the cars and insurance costs. And in those two areas, U.S. cars are doing better and better. Still, the all-time leaders in terms of low repair costs, as a general rule of thumb, would be such manufacturers' products as those that come from Toyota and Honda.
Okay, intermediate cars.
Well, again, we're talking about, we have some more U.S. cars here, the Buick Century, the Chevrolet Celebrity, Chrysler product, the Plymouth Caravelle, the Pontiac 6000 back again from GM, and then probably my favorite for the all-around safest car on the road today, the Volvo DL.
And finally, large cars.
Well, for those of you who are still looking for that traveling living room, there's some good choices out there. And they include the Chevrolet Caprice, the Ford LTD Crown Victoria, and the Mercury Grand Marquis. One interesting point about these three very large cars is that they have virtually remained unchanged now for about 8 years. So the manufacturers are really getting them right.
Now, in several of the new cars, there are twins. The car is made by two different manufacturers, or it's made by an American manufacturer and by a Japanese manufacturer. Are the twins 100% comparable?
Virtually 100% comparable. In many cases, such as with some of the products made by Mitsubishi for Chrysler, the only difference in the new car is the nameplate. One of the things that we tell consumers when shopping around for a new car is to consider these twins. For example, the Pontiac 6000 is virtually the same car as the Buick Century. You may find that the Pontiac 6000 will come at a lower price, or you can negotiate a better price for that particular car.
There are several innovations in the 1988 cars. More cars are having the option of four-wheel steering. What exactly is four-wheel steering, and do you think it's an important thing to have for the average driver?
Well, there's no question that four-wheel steering is the way of the future. It is currently available on a very limited number of Japanese cars, and essentially what four-wheel steering offers is two things. First of all, better handling in high-speed turning. With all four wheels turning and the rear wheels turning very slightly into the curve, you are going to be able to maintain better control over the car in a high-speed turn. Probably the most advantageous part of four-wheel steering, though, for the average driver, is the fact that you can now park the car, parallel park the car, in very small spots. So for anyone who drives the car in the city, that's a tremendous advantage. It's still a new innovation, and we don't expect it to be used on a widespread basis for at least 3 or 4 years.
New innovations always make a lot of consumers a little nervous because you don't know if it's perfected yet. Are the four-wheel drive cars, is the four-wheel drive perfected enough so that it's worth investing in at this point?
There's no question about the fact that four-wheel drive is here to stay. In fact, I'm predicting that we'll have mainly four-wheel drive cars on the road far before we'll have four-wheel steering. The only inherent drawback with four-wheel drive is the fact that many of the vehicles that have four-wheel drive are what we call off-the-road vehicles, such as the Jeep and the Suzuki Samurai, and these have very short wheelbases, and they tend to turn over very easily.
Now, what about four-wheel steering, which you just brought up? What is that, and do you think it's an important option to go for?
Well, no, I don't think it's an important option. I think you alluded to the fact that you should wait a few years before you jump into one of these new options, and you're absolutely correct. I don't recommend that consumers buy cars with four-wheel steering this year, and probably not next year either. But 3 years from now, when it becomes tested and the manufacturing of four-wheel steering becomes more consistent, then it's probably an option that you should consider very seriously.
In the protection area, some cars are coming with airbag protection. And I think it's mostly the more high-priced cars that have that option now.
That's right. This year, the U.S. Department of Transportation is requiring that one-fourth of all the cars sold in the United States have some form of automatic crash protection. And this comes in three forms. The airbags, which you mentioned earlier, which is my favorite and I think the most effective form of automatic crash protection. But it unfortunately is only available mainly in the higher-priced European cars. And then two other that are more popular and less expensive. They're forms of automatic belts. Basically, these two belts come in the form of motorized, which many of you may have already experienced, many listeners have already experienced, with a little motor that brings the belt gently around your body when you sit in the car, and then when you open the door, it gently takes the belt away. The other form, and I think it's particularly important to note that this is mainly on General Motors cars, is a belt that is not motorized, that's attached to the outside of the door. When the door swings open, the belt pulls away, and you're almost presented with almost a spider web. You don't know whether to step over these belts or get underneath them or whatever. And I fully believe that General Motors has purposely designed this system to turn consumers off to this important form of automatic crash protection.
What is the advantage of a motorized belt, assuming that you have a memory and that you want to use a seatbelt and you can buckle yourself up manually? Why would you want a motorized one?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, statistically speaking, only 15% to 25% of us buckle up on a regular basis, even though states are passing safety belt laws all over the country. And secondly, automatic crash protection is like an automatic sprinkler system in a building. It's always there when you need it, but you don't have to depend on your own memory to use it on a regular basis. And I think there's sort of a philosophy out there in America that, gee, if I want to kill myself in an automobile crash, that's my right. Why force me to pay extra for this form of automatic crash protection? Well, the bottom line is it costs society far more if you do kill yourself than if you stay alive. So it's really a cost-beneficial product for society as a whole.
More and more, let me reintroduce you, Jack, before we continue. My guest is Jack Gillis, and he's the Director of Public Affairs for the Consumer Federation of America. He's just completed new editions of The Car Book, which is a guide to shopping the new 1988 cars, and The Used Car Book, which is a guide to shopping for used cars in the year of 1988. More and more cars are coming with fuel injection instead of carburation. How do the two systems compare, and what are the benefits, what are the trade-offs for each for consumers?
Well, the good news is that the fuel injection systems, which are generally electronic, are far more efficient and less likely to break down. That's the good news.
Less likely to break down than carburation, or than they used to be?
than they used to be when they were first introduced. But then the carburation systems, which are, by their nature, mechanical devices and therefore more prone to break down. That's the good news. The bad news is that the average mom-and-pop mechanic who used to be able to do practically everything to your car is no longer able to maintain certain components in the car, which forces you to go back to the dealership, pay more for typical repairs, and in fact, you're not necessarily going to get repairs. You're going to get what I call replacements. Today's cars are replaced rather than repaired, so that when the repairs are necessary, they're going to be far more expensive. However, they should be less frequent.
Do you recommend fuel injection?
Well, it's not like a lot of us have a choice right now. Practically every time a new model is introduced today, it comes with some form of electronic fuel injection. The older cars that we talked about, in fact, the Chevrolet Caprice, the Ford LTD, Crown Victoria, some of those cars their engines are now being equipped with electronic fuel injection. So it's not like we have a choice, but I don't think the consumers need to be afraid of it, like I suggested they should be 3 or 4 years ago.
But you don't think they're necessarily missing the boat if they choose carburation over fuel injection?
Not at all.
Are there any other 1988 innovations that you think we should discuss?
Well, I think probably the biggest news for 1988 is the increased competition in the area of warranties.
Mm-hmm.
Automobile manufacturers are finally competing in an area which has some direct bottom-line benefit to the average consumer, and that is the warranty. We're keeping our cars longer and longer. The average price of a 1988 car is over $14,000, so that means we want this car to last for a long time. When in the past competition has focused mainly on moonroofs and color-keyed interiors, it's now focusing in this area of warranties. We're seeing that the U.S. warranties now are coming close to the European, which have always been the leader in offering the best warranties, and even the Japanese, which traditionally have had the worst warranties, are coming around, and Toyota and Mazda for 1988 have introduced excellent warranties.
What is the difference in the length of warranty between a good and a poor warranty?
Well, there's two things that are important in terms of shopping for a warranty. One is, how long is that powertrain coverage? And we've all heard Lee Iacocca spouting forth about how they have the longest powertrain warranty in the industry. And that's very important, and it's in fact true. However, the powertrain is only one component of the car. The other type of warranty is called the basic warranty. And the longer warranties on such cars as Mercedes go for as long as 48 months. The Toyota now has introduced a 36-month warranty. And that offers bumper-to-bumper protection. And the reason why that's important is because those items that are going to be most expensive to repair and most likely to fail, such as electric windows and other gadgetry, are covered, whereas they're not covered on these longer Chrysler warranties.
The foreign cars have traditionally been less expensive in some categories than American cars, but the American dollar has been fluctuating like crazy for the past few months. How is that affecting the price of foreign cars now?
Well, foreign cars are going to continue to increase in price, but I think what's important to note it note here is that we were going to have fewer and fewer so-called truly foreign cars. Honda now is gearing up to build a wide number of models here in the U.S., so is Toyota. Nearly every major Japanese manufacturer will be building cars here in the U.S., so that's going to do a lot to equalize the price between so-called domestic and foreign cars.
Now, some people will tell you that if you have a choice of getting the Japanese-built version of the car or the American-built version, to go for the Japanese-built version because they have better quality control. I had heard that from several people. You know how you hear things word of mouth. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Absolutely not. In fact, we, as a case in point, we took a good close look at the American-built Honda Accord and compared it with the Japanese-built Honda Accord. The fit and finish, the quality of assembly, and every feature of the car was every bit as good as its Japanese counterpart, which just goes to show you that U.S. workers can, in fact, build great cars. One of the key problems that the industry has had has not been that U.S. workers can't build good cars, is that management has chosen not to build quality into the assembly process. When management does that, U.S. workers have no problem building good cars.
Okay, well, I want to talk to you about one of the most difficult things about buying a car, and that is shopping for it. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Jack Gillis, who has just completed a new 1988 edition of the Car Book, which is a guide for shopping domestic and import cars. He's also completed the 1988 version of the Used Car Book, a guide to shopping for used cars. Gillis is also the Director of Public Affairs for the Consumer Federation of America. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jack Gillis, author of The Car Book and The Used Car Book, is my guest. Jack, I think for the remainder of the interview, instead of question and answer, we should negotiate.
All right.
Since we'll be talking about shopping. I really can't understand why you buy a coat and you pay the price tag. You buy, you buy a toaster oven and there's a price and you pay the price. You buy a car and there's like $1,000 or more margin that you can negotiate in, and you never know for sure if you're getting a great buy or if you're getting totally swindled. Why aren't there prices, hard and fast prices, like there are for most things in this world?
Well, there's a phenomenon in America that, as you suggest, we pay for everything based on its list price. But that phenomenon falls apart in the auto showroom. It's one of the few products that we Americans purchase that we negotiate for. And the problem is we're inexperienced at negotiation, we don't like negotiating, and we're matching wits with a seasoned professional. So the odds are against us in today's showroom in getting the best price. But there are a few things consumers can do, and basically I have three main very simple suggestions. First, never narrow your choice down to one car. Always pick two or three. And that's not as hard as it may sound, because today's cars are really more similar than they are dissimilar. Because once you've narrowed your choice down to one car, you lose that psychological advantage to be able to walk away from the deal. And which brings me to point number two. You always have to be prepared to do what I call the 180-degree turn. Always be ready to walk away from a deal. Even if the salesperson assures you that this is the very last model of its type, you'll never see another one like this, they're hard to get, believe me, in today's automobile market, there'll always be another one.
And chances are this person might come down in price, the dealer might come down in price once they see you turning around.
Absolutely. The minute you're prepared to walk out of that showroom, not only do you if you exhibit that attitude during the process, and I'm not saying this is going to be easy, because again, it's an intimidating situation for most of us, but if you try to exhibit that attitude and you are truly prepared to walk away if they won't accept your deal, then you'll always maintain the upper hand in the negotiation. The final tip is to find out how much the dealer paid for the car and negotiate up from that price rather than down from retail.
No, I think that's great advice, and I really can't figure out how to get a price like that. Once you know what the dealer paid, then you can figure out what their margin of profit is, and you can negotiate along with them. But it's very difficult to really find out what the price they paid for that car is.
Well, it's getting easier and easier. For example, there's a publication that's available in most bookstores and libraries called Edmunds New Car Prices, and that will list the dealer cost of the car and the retail cost of the car, plus many of the options. Now, this particular publication is updated every quarter, and it's not as accurate as other sources, but it'll at least give you a ballpark range. The second great source for this type of information would be from Consumer Reports Auto Buying Service. Now, this is something that you have to pay $10 per car for, but the company will send you a computer printout of the car, its dealer cost, and the cost of the options, as well as the dealer cost of the options. Also, many dealers now are advertising that they sell for what they call their invoice price. Now, beware, because the invoice price may include a bunch of options for which there's a high markup in, but oftentimes you will be able to actually get the dealer to show you the invoice.
I'm going to play dealer a second, okay? Jack, are you ready to buy today?
I'm ready.
Is that a good thing to say, that you're ready?
Sure.
Why?
Be very straightforward with the person and be prepared to buy if they meet your deal. The follow-up is, I'm ready to buy today if you will accept my offer.
Well, Jack,
no,
is there a price that I can beat that will ensure that you will buy today?
I'm willing to pay you $300 over the dealer cost of this particular car. Now, I happen to know this car cost you $12,000, so I'm prepared to write a check right now or arrange for the financing right now for $12,300. Would you accept my offer?
Okay, now I'm going to tell you that your price is wrong, and that actually the car cost me a lot more than you said it is, and that, you know, these magazines and reports aren't updated often enough, and they misquoted the price. And
well,
I'm going to have to charge you more than that.
Well, that may be true. Can you show me the invoice that indicates exactly how much you paid the dealer, the manufacturer, for this car? If I'm wrong, I'm willing to see your invoice and still pay you the $300 above your invoice cost.
Good. Okay. Now, one of the first things you're asked when you step into a showroom is, are you trading in your old car? Is this information that you should supply the dealer right away?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Well, keep in mind that you have three things that you're purchasing here. First of all, you're buying a new car, you're selling your old car, and you're arranging for financing. The dealer will want to throw all that into a pot and say, well, listen, would you like to pay $200 a month for this car? I can give it to you for $200 a month. Right there, you've made a determination on how much he's getting for the car, how much he's giving you for the trade-in, and how much you're going to pay in terms of finance costs. But you have no idea what those individual costs are. So what I suggest is you say you may or may not be interested in trading your car in. First, you want to negotiate the price of the new car. Then you'll sit down and negotiate the trade-in value of your used car, which you may choose not to trade in because you'll always do better selling it yourself. And then finally, you'll negotiate financing. And there, you have to shop around for financing just like you shopped around for your initial decision on which car to buy.
Now, the dealer is going to want to price the car that you're selling first before talking about the price of the new car. You're recommending the opposite order, that you price out the new car and then negotiate the trade on your car. Why is that order preferable?
Well, because your first goal really is to buy a new car. And in fact, I don't even recommend that you indicate that you're selling your used car, or, you know, try not to bring that into the discussion, because again, the dealer will keep that in the back of their mind when they're negotiating the price for the new car. So again, your first objective and your most difficult objective is to get that new car for the lowest possible price. That's why I suggest get that out of the way first and then make the choice to trade in. Now, again, keep in mind, if you choose to trade in your used car, you will only get, if the dealer is operating fairly with you, the wholesale price for that particular car. So if you look in what is called the Blue Book, which is available in most libraries and maybe at your bank, you can see the difference between the wholesale price and the retail price for your particular used car. And that difference is what you could make if you chose to sell it yourself. Now, you may decide that $250 or $300 difference isn't worth the hassle of trying to sell it yourself, so you'll be more than happy to trade it in. But you have to know both of those figures before you trade it in to ensure the dealer is giving you a fair value for the car.
Okay, so you'd really recommend saying, well, I don't think I'm going to trade my car, and then after you've gotten a good price on the new car, say, well, I changed my mind, I will trade in my new car,
absolutely,
my old car.
Absolutely. Yeah? That's exactly right.
Okay. Now, a dealer will frequently say to you, I have this great price that I can that I think I can get you, but I have to go check with the boss. And in order for me to actually get you this great price, I'm going to need a check, a deposit from you to show your willingness to buy, to show your commitment. Otherwise, he's going to laugh me out of the office. So Jack, give me a deposit before I go ask about this price.
Sure, no problem. That's one of the oldest techniques in the world. And what I suggest is don't hesitate to write out a check. Don't make it for more than $100. But simply write out a check for $100, and if the offer is not accepted, just ask for your check back.
Will you get it?
Yes, you will. I can imagine there may be some totally disreputable dealers, and I'm probably one of the hardest guys on dealers in the country, but I doubt if anyone wouldn't give you your check back.
So this isn't a big deal scam?
Absolutely. But the scam, though, is I've got to go talk with the manager. It would be great if you could follow that person back, and you'll find that probably 9 times out of 10, they're having a cup of coffee, They're calling one of their friends, they're making you wait. It's become a big game now. And the longer you wait, the more likely you will be to acquiesce to their offer just to get this very difficult and anxiety-producing process over with.
Are the dealer undercoating and rust-proofing processes worth getting?
Absolutely not. In fact, some of the manufacturers, including Toyota, specifically recommend against rust-proofing. The very holes where the rust-proofing is injected into the car are actually the items that are most likely to begin rusting.
But most of the cars come with that as part of the dealer prep.
Then don't take it, because their rust-proofing is extraordinarily expensive, and for my money, it's not worth it. Today's new cars have excellent corrosion warranties. Chrysler products, for example, are warranted for up to 7 years against surface penetration of rust on the outer body panels. So rust-proofing is, you know, there's a couple of problems with it in addition to being overpriced. Secondly, it's duplicative. Thirdly, you often have to pay a regular annual checkup fee to keep the rust-proofing warranty in effect. And fourthly, by its very nature, that car has already picked up some corrosive materials the moment it leaves the factory. So if you rust-proof or undercoat afterwards, you may in fact be sealing in corrosive materials.
So now we're talking about the dealer rust-proofing, but you don't recommend private rust-proofing anymore, do you?
Either rust-proofing or private rust-proofing.
Okay. Any kind of paint protection you recommend?
Absolutely not. again, manufacturers have done a great job putting paint on cars. After 3 years, start waxing your car. For a half hour's time, half three-quarters of an hour's time during the day, you can do far more to protect your paint than these plastic sealants, which have to be replaced every so often at a high expense. Fabric sealant is another big scam. It'll cost you anywhere from $79 to $129 to have the fabric in your car, so-called soil protected. I recommend you spend $5.95 on a can of Scotch Guard. That's exactly the same thing.
We only have a few seconds left, but are you good at this? When it's time for you to buy a new car, can you walk in there sure of yourself, confident, and negotiate a real good deal?
Absolutely not. It's a difficult process. And unfortunately, however, when I walk into a showroom, and I recently had this experience, I'm a challenge to these guys. So I have an even worse experience than the average consumer.
What, you threaten them, you mean?
Well, because here I come in as, you know, having been known as telling consumers how to buy cars cheaply, they're going to say, well, he's not going to get us down in price. We're really going to stick it to this guy. Well, he's a challenge to us.
Oh, so just one last thing. When you're shopping a car and they say, so, Mr. Gillis, what do you do for a living? Do you tell them, well, I write the car book?
That's the problem. Unfortunately, they already know that.
I see. Okay. Well, thanks very much for sharing some of your findings with us. Thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
My guest has been Jack Gillis, and his new editions of The Car Book and The Used Car Book, the 1988 editions, have just been published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Tony Hendra. For 8 years, he was the editor of the National Lampoon. He directed the satirical review Lemmings, and he had a role in the film This is Spinal Tap. He also co-created the British TV series Spitting Image. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with jazz critic Martin Williams. He compiled the new Smithsonian six-record set of swing band recordings, showcasing the big band's best singers and soloists. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward on another collection, the now classic Phil Spector Christmas album, featuring the Crystals, the Ronettes, Darlene Love, and others. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Western Lands, a new novel by William Burroughs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. Gary Hart says he's back in the race. The former Colorado senator was in New Hampshire today to announce his re-entry into the 1988 presidential contest. He dropped out last spring after reports that he spent a night with a Florida model. Today, Hart stood with his wife Lee at his side on the steps of the New Hampshire State House and made his announcements.
I have a sense of new direction and a set of new ideas that our country needs, that no one else represents. And I intend to resume my presidential campaign to let the people decide.
Former Arizona Governor Bruce Babbitt is one of the six other Democratic candidates. He said he thinks Hart will either become a front runner or the ghost of Christmas past. A consultant to the presidential campaign of Senator Paul Simon said, I guess they can go back to calling the candidates the Seven Dwarfs. And Republican National Committee Chairman Frank Fahrenkopf says he thinks Hart's return is great. It's another quiet day of confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Anthony Kennedy. Today is day two of Kennedy's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. NPR's Mara Liasson has details.
Judge Kennedy's answers today helped to create a picture of a very different kind of judge than the last high court nominee before this committee, Robert Bork. Committee Chairman Joseph Biden asked Kennedy again today whether he thought the Constitution guaranteed a marital right to privacy. Today, Kennedy answered simply, yes, it does. When Judge Bork was asked that question, he replied that he hadn't been able to find that right in the Constitution. This afternoon, Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy probed the judge about his views on criminal law issues, including the Miranda ruling. Kennedy told Leahy he thought the Miranda rule should be respected, but that he wasn't sure the original ruling was constitutional. Perhaps the clearest statement of Judge Kennedy's overall philosophy came this morning, at the end of a long exchange with Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter. It's somewhat difficult to offer myself as someone with a complete cosmology or an overarching theory of the law, Kennedy said. I'm still searching for the correct balance in constitutional interpretation. On Capitol Hill, I'm Mara Liasson.
A trial began today in Rome for the airport terrorist attack 2 years ago that left 16 people dead, including five Americans. Three died in a simultaneous attack at a Vienna airport. The major defendant in the trial, Palestinian leader Abu Nidal, is not in Italian custody. Silvia Pagioli reports from Rome.
A few months after the attacks, the sole survivor of the four-man commando in Rome, Ibrahim Mahmoud Khaled, began cooperating with investigators, supplying detailed descriptions not only of the Rome and Vienna attacks, but also of the Abu Nidal group's organizational structure. But at the opening of the trial today, Khaled told the court he is not repentant. The defendant pinned blame for the airport massacre in front of the El Al and TWA ticket counters, also on the Israeli guards who opened fire on the Arab commando. According to investigators, the original plan included the hijacking of an El Al plane and its mid-air explosion over Tel Aviv. The trial was adjourned until Monday when Khaled will take the stand. For National Public Radio, this is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
Israeli troops killed two more Palestinians in the Gaza Strip today, raising the official death toll to 10 after a week of demonstrations in the occupied territories. Palestinian sources say a third person was killed and three others seriously wounded when Israeli troops stormed the Shifa Hospital in the Gaza. Gaza itself is now like a ghost town, with nearly all shops closed and gangs of youths roaming back alleys. A storm that covered Sunbelt cities with record snowfalls hit the Midwest today, snarling highway and air traffic and unleashing tornadoes across four southern states. More than a dozen deaths have been blamed on the weather system, including at least six from a tornado that hit West Memphis, Arkansas last night. Stock prices rose for the second straight day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 8 points to close at 1941.48. This is NPR News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has a review of the classic rock and roll Christmas album. It was conceived and produced by Phil Spector, one of the most influential producers in pop history.
Rock and roll, for such a rebellious medium, sure has a long and intimate relationship with that most sentimental of holidays, Christmas. The list of rock and roll Christmas songs is so long, you can fill up 5 or 6 hours with nothing but, and I have. Whether it's Brenda Lee singing Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree or Jimi Hendrix's incendiary version of The Little Drummer Boy, there's a rock and roll Christmas song to fit your needs. But I'd like to suggest that the greatest rock and roll Christmas record of all is A Christmas Gift for You, which came out in 1963 and featured the talents of the Crystals, the Ronettes, Darlene Love, and Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans. These four groups were from the stable of the legendary producer Phil Spector. His wall of sound approach to recording had revolutionized American pop music at the end of the 50s and on into the early 60s. As a way of saying thanks to America's teens for his success, Spector arranged some pop Christmas songs and set about recording them, often with spectacular results.
Jimmy, I just came back from a lovely trip along the Milky Way. I stopped off at the North Pole to spend the holiday. I called on old dear Santa Claus to see what I could see. He took me to his workshop and told his plans to me. Now Santa is a busy man, he has no time to play. He's got millions of stockings to fill on Christmas Day. You better write your letter now and mail it right away, because he's getting ready, his reindeers and his sleigh. You better watch out, you better not cry.
That was the Crystals. Although the album included the Ronettes, with Spector's wife-to-be Ronnie singing the leads, the real star of the record is Darlene Love, a studio singer Spector had used on sessions, and around whom he had built the group Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans. To showcase her voice, he wrote the only new song on the album, Christmas, Baby Please Come Home, with help from Ellie Greenwich and Barry Mann.
Baby, please come home. The church bells in town.
album is perhaps Spector's masterpiece. From the masses of musicians, including Leon Russell on piano and Sonny Bono on percussion, to the amazing talent of the singers, it showcases his talent at length, the way nothing else ever did. But hey, let's let Phil have the last word here. He's deserved it.
Hello, this is Phil Spector. It is so difficult at this time to say words that would express my feelings about the album to which you have just listened. An album that has been in the planning for many, many months. First, let me thank all the people who worked so hard with me in the production of this album and in my endeavor and desire to bring something new and different to the music of Christmas and to the recording industry, which is so much a part of my life. Of course, the biggest thanks goes to you for giving me the opportunity to relate my feelings of Christmas through the music that I love. At this moment, I am very proud of all the artists, and on behalf of all of them, the Crystals, the Ronettes, Darlene Love, Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans, and myself, may we wish you the very merriest of Christmases and the happiest of New Years, and thank you so very much for letting us spend this Christmas with you.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. Phil Spector's A Christmas Gift for You is now available on both LP and compact disc. This is Fresh Air. Many music writers consider Martin Williams the dean of jazz criticism. For the past few years, he's worked at the Smithsonian Press, compiling a series of record anthologies, each highlighting a different facet of jazz or pop history. He's just completed his second big band anthology, called Singers and Soloists of the Swing Bands. It showcases outstanding performances by big band singers and soloists. In the booklet which accompanies this six-record set, Williams writes, "Nothing is included here only for the sake of a quick trip down memory lane, or merely because it sounded good at the time, or because it sold a lot of copies way back when."
You buy a set of nostalgia-oriented records, you play them maybe once and at a party a month later, and that's about it. We were trying to pick stuff and make a case for this music that was durable. That's kind of the business we're in, and that's how I like to do things. It's easy enough to look at yesterday's top 40 and pull your discs out of it, but it is maybe not so easy to decide, well, I think this really sounds good still, and I think it'll sound good in 20 years and maybe 100 years.
Your new box set opens with Bing Crosby singing with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. It's a 1929 recording of After You've Gone. Why did you begin with that recording?
Well, Crosby was the archetypal band singer who became a star later, who was singing as a featured vocalist with a prominent orchestra, and who then went on to have a big career after that. He's the beginning of that kind of thing in our popular music in this century, just about. Of course, that's a pattern that many others followed. Most successfully, of course, Frank Sinatra, after having been with Harry James and Tommy Dorsey. But there are many others, and several of them represented here. I think people would be surprised that Pearl Bailey was a band singer, that Lena Horne was a band singer.
I think for listeners who are used to considering Crosby the suburban crooner, it'll be very interesting to hear his 1929 performance of After You've Gone.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Crosby will surprise you. He really was heavily oriented in jazz before he became the romantic crooner. That's really where he learned everything. ¶¶
After you've gone, left me crying. After you've gone, there's no denying. You'll feel blue, you'll feel sad. You'll miss the dearest pal you ever had. There'll come a time, now don't forget it. There'll come a time when you'll regret it. Someday, when you grow lonely, your heart will break like mine and you'll want me only. After you've gone away.
Some of the selections that you've chosen in your new set are similar to the classical concerto form. And I think especially of Echoes of Harlem, Duke Ellington's showcase piece for trumpeter Cootie Williams.
Yeah, very definitely. And he had that kind of thing in mind. In fact, the original title of that thing was Cootie's Concerto.
Well, this was a 1936 recording. Mm-hmm. Why did you make a point of including this in the set?
Because it's another example of an excellent vehicle piece featuring one soloist, one improvising player out of the orchestra, standing down in front and having his great moment.
Anyone who thinks that the big bands are just for swing music of the 40s, the kind of music we associate with, say, Benny Goodman, you've included some much more modern-sounding music on it, and I think of Mingus Fingers, the Charles Mingus composition, where he's a featured soloist with the Lionel Hampton Band in 1947. Can you talk about that piece?
Well, that was something that Charlie had written for himself when he was quite a bit younger, and it's very much in the style that was called bebop, or what later began to be called modern jazz. Of course, it was the modern jazz of the middle 40s, and he was under the spell of Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. And it's actually, if you really want to get technical, it's a quite ingenious use of the chord progression to Gershwin's I Got Rhythm, but it's patterned in quite an original way. And there were very few vehicles for bass players before this thing came out. I can think of only two. And therefore, this was, an exceptional kind of thing for anybody to do. But Mingus played the bass like a great guitarist. But this was his first featured thing anywhere on records except some records he had made on his own in the very small groups out in California before this.
I'll tell you one of the choices that really surprised me. Finding Chattanooga Choo Choo, the Glenn Miller, Tex Beneke, Modern Airs recording. I'll tell you the truth, to me that recording is roots of middle-of-the-road music, and I was really surprised to see it showing up.
Well, I quite agree. It is, you see, and that's one of the things that we discover in a thing like this, how this middle-of-the-road and very middle-American-oriented swing, because Miller was the guy who got the people in Cedar Rapids doing the jitterbug, not the ones that Benny Goodman got, who on the East and West Coast. And this is really a production number. In fact, it was specifically written for that, for a movie. And I went back and listened to it again, and I said, wow, that thing is really good for what it is. It's almost perfect.
Hi there, Tex, what you say?
Step aside, partner, it's my day. Bend an ear and listen to my version
of a really solid Tennessee excursion.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga Juju?
Yes, yes, track 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine.
When you first started writing about jazz criticism, you really changed the way in which it was written. What was the state of jazz criticism like when you started writing about that music?
Did I? Well, I must say that I did say to myself, I think there's another way to do this. I don't think I said it was a better way, but there's a different way of looking at this. Of course, a lot of people, if you want me to talk personally, when I first started, many people said, oh, he doesn't really like music. He doesn't really like jazz. I guess nobody says that anymore.
They said that because you weren't just writing, I loved it, it was great, it was hot.
Well, it seemed to me that a lot of writers who were writing about jazz at that time had various clever ways of saying, golly gee whiz, or on the other hand, saying, yuck. And neither one of those things, however you phrase them, seemed to me to be really very much more than elementary. And I sort of said, well, you know, what is this thing I'm trying to either praise or damn? Have I really understood it? What is it technically? What is it emotionally? What are these people trying to do? And do I think it's worth doing? But the real questions I think that any critic ought to try to answer as best he or she can is, how and why do I say what I say? It isn't peddling opinions. It really ought to make the reader, sometimes force the reader to decide what he thinks. That's what it's really about.
At the beginning of our interview, you talked about how you want to see this music and have other people hear this music outside of the haze of nostalgia. Nevertheless, do you have a different way of hearing music that you actually grew up listening to, music that has personal associations for you, than you have of hearing music that you've come to with a certain distance between you and that music?
Well, I think I can divorce myself from remembering that, you know, that was the night when I held the first girl's hand for the first time or whatever. I think I can do that. What really pleases me is going back to some of these things and saying, I liked that when I was a teenager. Gosh, it really sounds good still. Now, that isn't always the case by a long shot, but when it does happen that way, it's very nice.
Jazz critic Martin Williams, singers and soloists of the Swing Bands, is available through the Smithsonian Institution. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we're following the amazing announcement by Gary Hart that he's once again a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination, asking voters, politicians, even our satirists, what they make of that. Also, a word that President Reagan says Mikhail Gorbachev told him the Soviets intend to cut off aid to Nicaragua, and a man in Texas who perceived a glut this summer in knockoff Ken dolls in South Korea and now has a problem.
What's his problem?
His problem is that he bought up lots of dolls to make little Oliver North dolls out of them, and nobody is buying for the solution. You'll have to tune in later.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of The Western Lands, a new novel by William Burroughs. Like his best-known book from the 50s, Naked Lunch, it's a trip through decadence and desperation, but in the 80s, Burroughs is more cosmically oriented.
William S. Burroughs, godfather of the Beat Generation and high priest of the drug culture in such sacred texts as Naked Lunch and Nova Express, has never been an easy writer. He hallucinates. And The Western Lands, which completes a demonic comic book trilogy begun in 1981 with Cities of the Red Night, is more of a jumble than most of his novels. It's almost unintelligible unless we understand that he is elaborating a personal pulp-paranoid cosmology, derived from science fiction, detective stories, paperback westerns, pornography, and Eric von Däniken. According to this cosmology, about 100,000 years ago in the Gobi Desert, we were attacked by a black hole, which caused mutations. These mutations had red hair. Secretly, they were invaders from Venus, and they've been in charge ever since. The invaders are to blame for monotheism, the Industrial Revolution, the Communist Party, the CIA, the H-bomb, and all governments currently operating. They deploy dream killers who get into our sleep, and DNA police who get into our genes, and evil eyes who target all writers, artists, filmmakers, and intellectuals considered a danger to the big picture. Fighting these Venusians are the natural outlaws, wild boys, pirates, pariahs, junkies, reverse vampires known as breathers, and a secret service of subversives called Margaras. The Western Lands is mostly about Margaras, Sanskrit for hunter. Margaras is for explorations of outer and inner space, and against the Thought Police. Its agents go back and forth in time, usually to ancient Egypt, where they seek the immortality of the Western Lands that was promised in the Book of the Dead. This is standard mystical quest, except that Burroughs tricks it up with fancy uniforms, kinky sex, cobra venom, Star Trek weaponry, a centipede god, and a hatred of women. It's a deforming hatred. The outlaw heroes are always male, homosexual warriors wading naked in rivers of blood and excrement, for whom, quote, danger is a biologic necessity. Not by accident are their enemies from Venus, the planet of love. Women, says Burroughs, are the parasitic other half, corruptors of natural man. They smell as bad as one of his breathers, like, quote, burnt plastic and rotten oranges. This is frankly a drag. For all its lyric twists and macabre humor and astonishing inventiveness, the Western Lands twitches between nightmare and wet dream. Until that is the end, when the novelist who imagined these outlaws abandons all hope. Not very good sci-fi, he says of his own book, quote, there isn't any transport out, there isn't any important assignment, it's every man for himself. There's a valedictory sadness here that startles. Surely, after 30 years of naked lunch, Burroughs hasn't decided to wear a shroud. Say it isn't so. I don't like his cosmos, but mine's no bargain either.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The Western Lands by William Burroughs. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with pilots Gina Yeager and Dick Rutan. They made aviation history circling the globe without refueling. Their plane, the Voyager, just went on exhibit at the Smithsonian. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the career of Jascha Heifetz, hailed by many as the greatest violinist of the century. He died last Friday. And just in time for finals, Jan-Harald Brundtvand will trace the urban legends revolving around college exams. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show is produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.